You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 19th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
All right, so guys, I'm almost not sick. That's where I'm at.
Thanks
to Steve.
You've been sick for all of April, have you not?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
I am getting sick, you guys. I woke up today with like that post-nasal drip, that burning in my throat. I've been popping cough drops with benzocaine like candy. I'm so annoyed because I'm on a plane tomorrow, as of this recording, right? It's the middle of the week. I'm on a plane tomorrow to co-host the March for Science.
Cool.
Oh, awesome.
I'm hosting the rally. Yeah.
Where,
up
DC?
On stage.
Wow.
In DC, the big one.
Awesome.
With Derek Muller of Veritasium and Questlove Gomez of The Roots. It's going to be so much fun.
Are you flying United?
I really hope I'm not sick. I actually told them not to book a United ticket. So I'm in the clear. But get this, you guys.
Whoa.
Literally last week, we were talking about styes, remember?
Yeah.
I got a freaking sty in my eye.
How?
Uh-oh. Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Did you touch Bob?
Oh my gosh. I got one on Friday. It popped up out of the blue. I texted Bob frantically, like, how do I treat this?
It must be psychogenic, Kara.
No, it's...
You gave it to yourself.
You willed it. You willed it.
It's just a really weird coincidence, you guys. And so I go...
Should have read the secret, you know?
Right? I go to the grocery store or the pharmacy because I'm like, what can you do to treat a sty? Bob's like, you know, hot compress. And of course, that's what I ended up doing. But I'm looking to see if there's any ointments or anything. All homeopathic.
Yeah.
Every single thing on the shelf. Because all you can really do for a sty is put a hot compress on it. But I did a hot compress four times a day, like you're supposed to, over the course of the 3 or 4 days that it takes for it to go away.
Yikes.
And it destroyed the skin around my eye. It's peeling.
Maybe it was too hot.
Wait,
what did
that?
I
just have very, very sensitive skin.
How hot were you going?
Just, you know, warm. Not so hot that it was burning or anything. But I have the kind of skin where if you scratch your arm, it whelps up and will stay like that for an hour.
Oh, wow.
It's just very reactive to heat and to abrasions and stuff. Yeah. So I'm dealing with that now. It's really fun.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my attitude is sty schmy. Talk to me when it turns into a hard lump that needs to be removed surgically by injecting Novocaine into your eyelid. And we'll
the
talk.
The little bump is still there. It's gone way down, so my eyelid doesn't look droopy and stupid anymore. But there's still a little hard nodule in my lid. It just doesn't hurt. Oh, I'm hoping that's just a remnant and it goes away.
Probably.
Just pierce it. Put a piercing in there.
Yeah, just cover stick it a needle in my eye. Like Newton.
Well, you guys are so cute because last week I felt like I was getting sick. You know when you from 1 minute to the next you feel like a sickness? It's like, yeah, something's coming.
I'm there and right now.
So I felt that last week and then an hour later it was gone.
Oh, I hope that I... Yep. I hope in catching your sty, I also catch your not quite sick sickness.
I just rolled a 20 when it comes to constitution.
You could interpret it that way.
You can't actually say... When you say you rolled a 20, Bob...
Yeah.
Is that a 20-sided die? What does that mean?
What are you talking about, Jay?
It would be more accurate for you to say, I have an 18 constitution.
Well, it depends on what system you're using, 3 or 3.5.
Okay. It's getting too nerdy in here.
And you talk about the technical names of all these drugs, but when it comes to D&D versions,
exactly. I can't handle it anymore. Oh my gosh. Wait. One more thing. My mom texted me a picture the other day of her and her husband at the Renaissance Fair. I had no idea my parents were nerds.
Yes,
that's awesome. You got to go with
level two geekdom.
They were secret nerds. I asked them if next up they were going to start LARPing. They laughed, but we'll see.
They knew what that meant? Uh-oh.
Kara, they laughed. They laughed, but they looked at each other.
They're
halfway there. Right?
Exactly.
Like, well, should we tell her?
They had full costumes. Like, he had a Scottish kilt.
They're LARPing.
Yeah.
People who go to Ren fairs and dress up want to LARP, even if they don't realize it yet. And then once you do LARP, you're like, why the hell was I wasting my time going to Ren fairs?
Exactly. Yeah.
I just love that she's discovering this in her late 60s. It makes me so happy.
Good for them,
I
know. Man.
I love it.
Very cool.
All right, Kara, what's the word?
The word this week is a good one. So last week, on my social media channels, I always share all the cool science stories of the week that I come across. And last week, I shared a story about a possible link between celiac disease and the T1L reovirus. A bunch of people thought it was an autocorrect from retrovirus. I actually did too the first time I saw the article until I read deeper. And so, you know, so many people pointed out, oh, you mean retrovirus? It's like, no, it's actually a reovirus. So why haven't we heard of them? Because they're insanely common. And in fact, you guys, probably we all have some in our gut or our respiratory tract right now, because we commonly carry them and they don't often cause disease. Reoviridae is actually the family name of a reovirus. There are 9 genera underneath that, but only 4 of those have been known to infect animals: orthoreovirus, rotavirus, coltavirus, and orbivirus. And oftentimes when we say the word reovirus, it's sort of shorthand for orthoreovirus, even though it can also refer to the overall family. If you subdivide that more, we've probably all heard of rotavirus. Rotavirus group A causes the most human disease of all the reoviridae combined. It still causes hundreds of thousands of diarrheal deaths every year, but often those are in kids, elderly individuals, and they're usually in developing countries.
There's a vaccine.
We've had a vaccination program in place for a long time, and so our infection rates are really low. But even if we do have infection rates, it's usually well managed with proper care, like most diarrheal diseases. But in developing nations, it's really, really hard to combat that. So specifically, we define reoviruses by their lack of a lipid envelope, their double-stranded RNA, and this is the coolest part, they have these concentric capsid shells where their DNA is packaged, sometimes 2, sometimes 3. It's like shell, shell, shell. And here's a really cool thing. The term reovirus was coined in 1959 by Albert Sabin of polio fame. He actually developed the live attenuation oral polio vaccine around the same time that Jonas Salk developed his killed vaccine. So it was coined by Sabin, and it's actually an acronym for respiratory enteric orphan virus, reovirus. Orphan, not because it was found in orphans, but because when it was first discovered, it wasn't found to actually have a relationship to disease. It seemed to be only in healthy individuals, and nobody could track down how that virus was connected to any disease state. Since then, obviously we've discovered the few that I mentioned, but still most reoviruses can be found in fecal swabs and in totally healthy individuals. It's pretty interesting.
All right. Here's a bit of trivia. Who invented the rotavirus vaccine?
Johnny Roto-Rooter. Paul Offit.
That is correct.
What?
Yes.
Paul Offit.
Nice.
With Fred Clark and Stanley Plotkin. But yeah, he's one of the co-inventors.
Holy crap.
The rotavirus vaccine. Yeah, isn't that cool?
Very cool.
Sweet. All right. Thanks, Kara. That's interesting.
Yeah.
We're going to go on to some news items. So what do you guys know about the Ice Age megafauna extinction?
Those are some big fauna.
Lots of animals died. The big animals died.
So we've talked about this on the show actually a few times.
Did humans do it, or was it some environmental thing? That's a big question, right?
Yes. So like from about 15,000 to 11,000 years ago, when the last glacial period was ending and the glaciers were melting, the megafauna, not just of North America, but also of Europe, those were dying off. They were going extinct. Basically, the world was losing its megafauna. Like the really big animals.
Give some examples. Mastodon.
Like the woolly mammoth. Yeah, the mastodon. The saber-toothed lion and the giant tree sloth, for example. So the question has been, was it mainly due to hunting by people? Did we, kill and eat them? Or was it due to all the environmental change that was happening at the transition, the end of the glacial period, like in the movie Ice Age, The Big Melt? You may have seen that, Kara.
The cartoon?
Yeah, remember? Yes.
I did not see that.
Is some combination of the two an appropriate
Or some
answer?
Combination of the two. There
it's
were two
not a cartoon.
Stretches.
It's a CG spectacle.
I apologize. Yeah,
yeah. Well, now researchers have a third hypothesis or a third factor that may have contributed to the megafauna extinction. They say that they may have died off partly because it was moist.
What?
What?
Humidity?
They were too moist. Moisture.
I don't like that word moist. How many more times are you going to say
it? I know. That's why I'm saying it is one of those words, like when you use the voice, like moist.
He's moistly done saying it.
Yeah, moistly. So here's what they think happened. Well, first let me tell you the evidence that they have for it, so that you could look at the bones, right? Look at the bones of the dead animals, and you could tell by looking at the nitrogen isotopes.
It's nitrogen.
That, yeah. Especially in the bones of herbivores, you could tell what kind of plants they were eating. And there's a different isotopes between the kind of plants that you will see in dry environments and the kind of plants that you will see in moist or wet environments. And what they find everywhere they look is a sharp uptick in the moisture of the plants that the megafauna were eating right before they went extinct. So what could have happened is that all of the water that was melting from the glaciers was putting moisture back into the air. And at the time, you had which is actually similar to now, you had a lot of open grasslands. And the megafauna were largely adapted to these large open grasslands. But then as the moisture content of the environment increased, grasslands would turn into swamps and then into forests. Because that's what basically determines those ecosystems, right? You know, grasslands are too dry to support forests. That's why they grow grass. But if they had enough water, they would grow – trees would start to predominate. They would take over. So the vegetation that you see in the grasslands is very different than the vegetation in a forest. Generally, forests have – forest greenery is much more toxic and difficult to digest. So animals that were well adapted to the grasslands – would have been under a lot of stress to try to survive in either swamp or forests. So that's their hypothesis, that melting glaciers, increased moisture, you know, ecological change from grasslands to swamp to forest happening, you know, pretty much right at the moment where, you know, geologically speaking, when the megafauna was going extinct. So this is one study. This is one line of evidence. It'd be nice to see that the ecosystems were actually changing, you know, not just, you know, a suggestion that they could have been changing. Mm-hmm. This doesn't let, you know, human hunters or other climate change off the hook. This could, again, you know, oftentimes a mass extinction can be due to multiple factors hitting at once. Because you could think of it in terms of, obviously, something really big happens, you know, yeah, that can cause an extinction all by itself. But otherwise, you know, some big stressor species can migrate, they can adapt, you know, there's a little bit of flexibility in there. But you have two or three stressors at the same time, and you can get entire ecosystems collapsing and mass extinction. So it certainly could be that all three of those stressors were important factors in the recent megafauna extinction. Cool. But of course, you read it and like moisture killed the, you know, the woolly mammoth. Really? Moisture?
It sounds so not real.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't. It's not. Sometimes we hear about science and it just computes. It just seems very likely. It's like, oh, of course. Yeah, that makes sense. I can reason through it. And then sometimes you hear these kind of these hypotheses that just don't sit well logically for whatever reason. It's like opposite truthiness. I'm not feeling this.
Well, it's counterintuitive, right? So we just say everything that's counterintuitive is wrong. Sometimes things are counterintuitive because of limitations of our intuition.
Look at quantum mechanics.
Yeah, it looks what feels absolutely right. So we have to, but certainly you have to think carefully about things like that. Does this not feel right because there's something wrong with it or because it's just different? It's just not what I would expect. Is it just a limitation of my own expectations? I mean, at the end of the day, I think they have a perfectly reasonable line of evidence. It's just fairly thin, you know, as evidence goes.
What specifically is it that they couldn't process their food as well? Is it because their food was getting drowned out, because they were losing habitat, because it was getting washed out?
Yeah, so what they're thinking is that it was the change in the plants that were available, and just the grass that they were living on wasn't available anymore. There were bushes and trees, and they weren't adapted to eating it.
Yeah.
So the animals that were better adapted to that vegetation predominated.
Look at the character Moist from Dr. Horrible. I mean, does that look like an evolutionary cul-de-sac to you?
I don't know him. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Have you seen Dr. Horrible, Kara?
No.
Put it on the list.
Damn it, the list is so, it's impossibly long.
Oh, forget it. The list is just,
we're starting to get pissed off, Kara.
I know, we're going to end up having some like clockwork orange session one of these days. My eyes are just going to be like pinned open.
But you have seen the clockwork orange.
Absolutely, and I've read it, and and the version
good answer,
that I
Kara,
read, yes,
even if you didn't, good
by
answer.
Anthony Burgess, right? The version that I read did not have a dictionary in the back. Apparently,
oh, then how the hell did you know what the half
I know. Apparently, now you can buy it with like a glossary of terms.
Yeah, it has a glossary.
It was all context clues when I read it.
No, I had a version a long time ago that had the dictionary in the back.
Yeah, the glossary.
Okay, so I just bought maybe the $2 less version that I shouldn't have bought.
Yeah.
But yes, very, very good. Love it.
You know what the slang is, right?
Double plus good?
No. That's 1984. The slang from
Oh, you're right. That was 1984.
Yeah, the slang from A Clockwork Orange, it's all bastardized Russian.
Oh, yes. Interesting.
So, like, good in Russian is хорошо. And that got bastardized
horror
into
show.
Horror show.
The horror show.
Brilliant. Horror show. Yeah. Brilliant. I love that.
That is
real
brilliant.
Horror show. My wife
studied
Russian in college, and that's when I read and saw it for the first time. So she was like able to translate all of the slang.
Oh, cool.
Oh, cool.
Devochka. Devochka is, you know, an old woman. Yeah. So if you
that's
read it
awesome.
Again, all those words are actually either Russian or bastardized Russian. It's cool.
What about Mr. Deltoid?
Sense. Yeah.
Mr. Deltoid, yes. A little bit of extreme nastiness, yes.
How do you guys have such good memories for this shit?
Well,
that's what always blows my mind.
Oh, gosh.
How have you had enough time to watch all these movies 300 times? 300!
300!
See? You remember
31.
That.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. Bob,
yes.
I understand that oxygen is not as critical for life.
Eh.
Some people
speak for yourself.
Who needs it? So
I do.
Surveys done at Yellowstone National Park are elucidating the cool chemosynthetic life forms that live there. By doing this, they are also revealing details about not only the earliest life on Earth, but the likely alien life that also may exist in our very own solar system. Now, this study was done by Montana State University researchers. This was all laid out in their paper in the journal FEMS Microbiology Ecology. The paper is called Ecological Differentiation in Planktonic and Sediment-Associated Chemotrophic Microbial Populations in Yellowstone Hot Springs. I love those titles. Holy crap.
very technical.
So Yellowstone National Park is known for its diverse flora and fauna, but the most interesting locations in Yellowstone would certainly kill almost any life on Earth if it tried to actually live there. Of course, I'm referring to the hot springs. They are of course colorful and beautiful, but they're also deadly as hell. But it's not anathema to all of life. My good friends, the extremophiles,
yes.
These microbes can take the heat and acidity in stride. Because that's what they do. So these are typically bacteria and archaea, which are like bacteria, but even older and more diverse, such that they have their own domain, which we touched upon, I think, last week or the week before.
Mm-hmm.
So Montana State University did a survey. They took samples from 15 hot springs in the park, and they looked at two different types of microbes, ones that were either swimming freely, called them planktonic, or they stayed in the sediment. They're just in the sediment, and that's where they hang out and spend all their time, not swimming around in the water at all. They also examined very closely the water and the sediments themselves to see what their chemistry looked like. So one of their main goals was to study the oxidants that these organisms use. Now, an oxidant, you may guess, is simply the substance that an animal uses to capture energy. For humans and most animal life, that's oxygen. Oxygen is wonderful. It's very efficient at doing what it does and keeping us alive. But chemosynthetic organisms don't have oxygen available for whatever reason. They use other less efficient oxidants like an oxidized iron or sulfur to do the work. It's not as good as oxygen, but hey, I mean, if that's what's around you, then that's fine. And it does work. So the findings. So the researchers found that the extremophiles in the water were mostly microaerophiles. Probably guess from the name itself what that means. They can't live long without oxygen, but they can get by with far less than is usually required. If, for example, the Earth lost a boatload of the oxygen that's in our atmosphere, say down to whatever, like 10-15%, they would still be fine. They'd be totally fine. But of course, billions of animals would die if that happened, actually. So that's the planktonic microbes. They were the micro aerophiles. The extremophiles in the sediment in the hot springs were mostly chemosynthetic, relying on inorganic substances as an oxidant like sulfur and iron. Now, chemosynthetic, I know we've mentioned this. I didn't really mention in detail what exactly that is. We've mentioned it many times on the show. Basically, it's a form of life that derives its energy not from the sun or photosynthesis in any way, but mainly from the environment and from minerals and things that are available in the environment, which has always fascinated the hell out of me. There's these creatures that live not only at Yellowstone Park in the hot springs, but also at the bottom of the ocean by these vents, these deep sea hydrothermal vents that are over 200 degrees and incredibly dense. You know, imagine how dense the water is at that depth. And they're just like, la, 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 this is nothing. This is fine. And there's like no photosynthesis anywhere. And they're getting around. So regarding these results, Daniel Coleman, a geomicrobiologist researcher, said, understanding the present day distribution of microorganisms as they relate to environmental factors can provide an idea how life evolved in response to changing environments over Earth's history and over the history of life's evolution. So that's part of the point right here. The earliest life on Earth had to be chemosynthetic, right? The first oxygen was not produced by cyanobacteria or blue-green algae until, say, 3 billion years ago, or maybe 2.7 billion years ago. So you're talking a huge chunk of time where there was like basically no oxygen. So what was life doing? Well, of course, these extremophiles were living off of what was available to them, and it wasn't oxygen. So these extremophile archaea organisms are basically the closest relatives to the first life that was on Earth. So learning more about them teaches us about what the first life was like. So that's one huge benefit. So the other major point here for me anyway was that this knowledge could also help us to better prepare for the non-terrestrial life that we may find, say, on Europa or Enceladus. And let me tell you, it looks pretty good, in my opinion, that's exactly what we're going to find. I think if I had to put money on it, I would bet that we are going to find some weird chemosynthetic organisms that are not based on our DNA at all on these planets. Everything is there.
So, Bob, let me ask you a question, Bob. Do you think it's dangerous for us to bring something that alien back to Earth?
No, not at all. I mean, if this is alien biology with DNA not like ours and different proteins, it's not like in the movies. How are they going to possibly infect us or do anything to us if it's completely alien biology? It'd be like trying to interface a basic computer language with C++. It's like they just don't mesh. They don't work well together. How's that going to work? It would the alien life would see us as something just so foreign that it wouldn't. What could it do?
But Bob, isn't that what the aliens want you to believe?
Do you think these, let's say there are these life molecules out on Enceladus or Europa, that in these jets that are being spewed basically out into space, is the life within those jets being spewed out? In other words, is it something we can like fly by and capture? We don't have to actually land on the planet and just go grab samples of that, and we'll
Absolutely.
Know right away.
They're probably not alive anymore, but we could certainly capture organic material in those
sure.
jet streams. Yeah, absolutely. We would learn a lot if we could directly sample, those geysers from Enceladus. Absolutely.
How cold are those guys? I mean, they're out in space. Like, is the water just freezing instantly?
Sure.
And then we just like have to grab like an ice cube or an ice.
Yeah, a lot of it is
an icicle. Ices.
The crystals. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure they crystallize very quickly.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob. I don't think we need any sort of new technology to invent or that we have to wait on in order to do this. Can't we just design the probes to go into orbit around these moons, have them collect whatever is being spewed up into space, collect the stuff and analyze it?
Well, they have to figure out a way to collect it. I mean, that's all engineering, like massive engineering feats.
Yeah,
I mean, we don't have the collector technology in order to.
Well, the real game changer, the real game changer are these vents. That they were the game changer because that means that it is bringing stuff from the subsurface out onto the surface and in space. Because otherwise, before that, everyone was talking about we got to drill and it's going to be deep and then you don't want to infect it and all this stuff. That's major engineering. That's like, whoa, that's like a major, never been done really off planet ever before. This stuff is like waiting for us. There could be fossils laying on the surface of Europa or Enceladus right now, just waiting for a good camera to take a real good close up. Or for some, you know, analyzer to examine what's there, or it could be in, you know, being spewed into space. So you don't even have to land potentially. So that's the game changer.
Do you think that there could be fossils?
Not necessarily, no, but some evidence, some sort of fossilized remains that would point to some sort of organisms. I mean, we see remnants from microbes that are billions of years old from the tunnels they made or things that they excreted. So now I'm not necessarily looking for hard shells, although that would be cool too.
But we haven't even found that yet on Mars. Like, don't we feel like there's a good chance that that could exist on Mars? And we're like there rolling around looking at the rocks.
Yeah, not as much. Not as much. So Mars has a couple of disadvantages. Mars does not have liquid water on the surface, right? Although it might used to, and it may still have some underground. Mars has a lot of perchlorates in the soil, and that's very unfriendly to life.
Yeah, but at least it has soil. Deal killer.
Water's better.
Water is better. It's
Water's better, but Europa is much better opportunity for life.
Yeah, but I don't think water is better for fossilization. That's what I'm concerned about, is actually being able to find intact, something that points, because again, isn't that the astrobiologist quandary? It's like, even if we found life, would we know it? You know, where's the cutoff between the building blocks of life and something that's actually a functional organism?
Well, let's go take a look and find out.
Yes.
Evan, I think this news item gets my vote for like the worst reporting. Now, wait a minute.
But Steve, doesn't the headline say it all?
Tell us about
this. Device that can literally read your mind, invented by scientists.
Oh, how come I haven't heard about that?
because you read real science, Kara.
Crap.
It is described as an easily operated machine linked to a smartphone, could be ready within 5 years. Okay, so
they're
projecting.
Years.
Project, right, there it is. 5 years, 10 years. The sweet spot, right, of science. Well, okay. So a research group from Toyohashi University of Technology in Japan had a press release just recently in which they announced that they've developed a technology that can recognize, well, here's their work they did on it, that can recognize the number 0 to 9 with 90% accuracy using brain waves or EEGs while subjects utter the numbers. Right. So they utter the numbers and they have a technology that can sense through the brainwaves what number it is the person is uttering. Furthermore, the technology has also realized the recognition of 18 types of Japanese monosyllables from EEG signals with 60% accuracy. And they claim that shows the possibility of an EEG activated typewriter in the near future. That's a teletype, I suppose, of sorts.
Can you imagine a typewriter with a 61% accuracy?
It would.
Have you ever used the voice recognition software?
Yes, Dragon or
Like it was like at 95%, it's unusable. Seriously, you really need very, very high accuracy for those things to be anything other than just an exercise in frustration.
Yeah, even Siri is still really frustrating for me. My car texts for me. I can tell it what to say, and it'll text people, and it always is weird. Yeah. It's never what I actually tried to say. Tell your car to send somebody a text. This happened to me the other day, saying, I'm really craving jicama rolls.
What?
Yeah, that did not do well.
It's just not going to get. But I have to find, I find it very, very helpful and useful. But I do need to consciously slow down and enunciate better. And then it's fine. Then it's really good. If I just talk conversationally, forget it.
Oh, no, forget it. And I tried that 5 times with jicama rolls, but they were hiccup my rolls and there were all sorts of things. So it doesn't know that word. That is not in the dictionary for some reason. Siri, get on this.
That's right. Come on, Siri. You're our only hope.
You're our only hope.
The obvious sort of purpose behind these experiments and these designs that they did was that they're hoping that in the near future, they'll have sufficient technology accessible enough in which people who have injuries or conditions in which they cannot express themselves vocally will certainly be able to do so with the help of artificial intelligence and these computers and then eventually as they're projecting forward into our smartphones. You just have an app on the smartphone for these people so that they can, you know, tell us with 90% accuracy what it is they are thinking. So,
yeah, it's all bullshit. You
know, yeah, it sounds quite dubious on the surface, and they certainly don't offer a lot of details. Now, they say the details of the research is going to be presented at something called Interspeech 2017, a convention of some sort held in Stockholm coming up in August. So I guess we'll get some more technical details of exactly what it is they're doing. But, you know.
So let me tell you what I think, though. So,
yeah,
from this.
Please.
So you can see from the pictures that they're using scalp electrodes, right? So these are not implanted electrodes. These are a cap of electrodes on the outside of your scalp. And they're using learning algorithms so that the computer can get better and better at sorting out like what EEG, you know, electroencephalogram activity your brain is having while you're doing these various things. There's a couple of limitations to this. So I would say at best, this is a very incremental advance on this technology. On the software, because there's the hardware technology that they're using, the electrodes and whatnot, they seem to be using off the shelf stuff. So that doesn't seem to be any technological advance there. It maybe they got a little bit better at writing the learning algorithm that is discerning the EEG patterns and, you know, being able to tell them apart. But I don't even know that because, you know, I don't know of other researchers who have tried to separate these specific kind of things. Other researchers mm-hmm. have focused on images or controlling a cursor or controlling a robotic arms, things like that. So this, you know, this could be just another example of research that's already been done, or at best it's a very slight incremental advance. But the article spends most of its time projecting this technology into the future with wild abandon and absolutely no restraint, you know. So, first of all, 5 years, get out of here. You know, that's just not going to happen. And then they say things like, yeah, they're hoping to get it into, like, the software into a smartphone. All right, that's probably the most plausible aspect of this. Even that I'm dubious about because, like, you know, I need to know, like, what kind of computing power are they using for this algorithm? And what are they expecting to get into a smartphone? Are they accounting on massive improvements in smartphone technology in 5 years? Or are they somehow thinking they're going to pare down the software? Because that doesn't seem very likely. Then they're saying that they're going to be able to do it with much fewer electrodes. Oh, that's just crap. I just don't agree with that at all. The whole point to improving computers' ability to differentiate what you're thinking from your brainwaves, from your EEG.
More connections.
Is more sensitivity, is more resolution. Yeah, they're saying we're going to do better with less resolution. Sorry.
How exactly
I don't
will
see
they
it.
Do
yeah,
that, right?
I don't see that. They're then expecting some kind of game change in their software ability, which I don't, you know, okay, I'll believe it when I see it, but I'm dubious about that. So, you know, what this technology really needs are better electrodes that we can put inside the skull safely and sustainably. That's the real thing. And then continued incremental advances in the software are fine. And again, at best, that's what we're seeing here. Now, the other thing that struck me is that the people were still talking. You know, like they were saying 0, 1, 2. Mm-hmm. That affects the EEG.
How come?
Yeah. That was one of my main questions is how.
Well, because muscles produce 100 times more electricity than your brain does, you know, through the skull. And so, yeah. So if if people are doing anything, you get these massive motor artifacts on your EEG. So I wonder how they're controlling for that. You know,
right. If I say the number one, how does it differentiate between the word O-N-E versus W-O-N, right?
Oh, I don't think we're anywhere near that. I mean, they're just...
Right. There's so much overlap, it seems, between...
Yeah.
Between, you know, the words we actually use in our everyday lives and sort of what the brain is putting out as these waves that is being read by the EEG, it'd be like, you know, too many different ways to interpret it. It leaves it like open to a lot of subjectiveness to me.
Yeah, I mean. what kinds of things, Steve, like as of EEG technology right now, can we tell by looking at an EEG readout? We can tell if somebody's eyes are open versus closed. Right?
Yeah, but that's kind of cheaty because your eye is a huge dipole.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
The retina is negative and the cornea is positive. I'm pretty sure that's
so
correct.
Even being
and
able so to tell if
you,
your eyes
you
are
close
open
your eyes,
cheating.
When you close your eyes, your eyes flip up. So you're flipping this huge dipole, which causes a massive artifact on your EEG. So yeah, so it can tell that because if your eye happens
because
to...
Because of the artifact.
Because your eye is a dipole. Right.
But we can't tell the difference between reading a number and saying
a
number.
Oh my God, no.
If we don't.
No,
like none of that. It's just like we can tell like different brain wave states in sleep and things with an EEG.
Yeah, we could tell. Obviously, we could tell the overall state of your brain. We could tell the different parts of your brain and we could see how the different parts of your brain are functioning in relation to each other. And the software is getting good at picking up, you know, more and more subtle changes in terms of, you know, regional differences in the EEG. And they're also, EEGs are obviously for detecting seizures. And so the technology and the software, et cetera, is getting good at picking out, you know, being able to analyze the waveforms and detect seizures and pick out intermittent abnormal waves, you know, pathological stuff like that. But knowing what you're thinking in any way, no. Mm-hmm. It's so far, you know, what we've needed either like a ton of electrodes on the scalp, and even that is not as good as having electrodes on the brain. We need real brain, sensitivity. Yeah. And then, you know, between a limited number. And the other thing is the other research has required a significant amount of training, not only of the software, but of the person. You know, you almost have to learn to control your brain waves in order to like move the cursor or move the robotic arm. They're saying they're going to eliminate that or have a very, very short training phase too. But I don't see any evidence to support that claim. Anyway, the reporting is terrible because it's all hype and it doesn't put this into context of what, like where we really are with this research. This is exciting. This is genuinely exciting. And I think 20 years from now, 30 years from now, this could be a real game changer in a lot of the ways that they say. But scientists did not invent a device that reads your mind. But that's we're going to see that headline 100 times over the next 20 years. Every time there's another incremental advance. But yeah, 100 incremental advances from now, maybe we'll be somewhere. But that doesn't make sexy headlines, right? The baby steps. So that's what we're going to see. But that's why it's good science. It's incremental. This whole field is very interesting, but we're a long way from something very practical and horrible science reporting. That's what we're dealing
with. Right. Certainly not 5 years away.
No. Yep. I'd be surprised. All right, Jay, this one has been making the rounds about Alex Jones, who I don't think we've actually spoken a lot about on this show. So tell us what's going on.
Yeah, I don't think we have. To be honest, I mean, I just kind of ignore the guy. You know, yeah, I tune him way out.
I agree. I think he's so far out there, it's like almost not even worth talking about.
I last brought him up, I think, at a Nexus maybe 5 or 6 years ago when we were talking about 9/11 conspiracies, and he definitely came up in that subject.
Well, I mean, I got a question before you even start, Jay. Why is this guy so ignorable? I mean, some people have said to us, you know, this guy rakes in a boatload of money. He taught. Mm-hmm. He has a huge audience. He has an incredibly popular website. Why do we ignore somebody?
I'll tell you why. I generally ignore him because I don't think he's sincere, and I don't want to like debunk claims that somebody's making that even they don't believe.
Interesting. Okay.
In case you, our audience, don't know who Alex Jones is, he is the host of a show called InfoWars where he delivers his, and this is all my opinion, his semi-delusional conspiracy-laden rants on current political affairs. Now,
semi.
If you watch his show, it's mind-numbing, you know, just how good this guy is at ranting and seemingly coming up with information on the fly. Like, you know, I don't know how he could possibly prepare that much BS for each one of his shows. He's got to be making it up as he goes. He often yells. He has a very very strong demeanor, and you know, and he is entertaining. I'll admit that, of course. I mean, the guy, you know, he has a very big personality, and he is entertaining even from a skeptic's perspective. Even though you want to puke when you hear what he has to say, so Bob was right. The guy has a real audience here. So he's got his show airs on 150 stations. He's got 7.6 million unique visitors on his website last month and 2 million subscribers on his YouTube page. And, you know, those numbers equate to big dollars at that size. He's making quite a bit of money off of his show.
But to see, I mean, what kinds of advertisers can he get? They can't be mainstream.
Guns and ammo? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, you know, isn't that how you make your money, though? Most of your money's from ad sales, right?
Yeah,
the Survivalist Store.
Well, he has two websites.
That's true. Gold, right? He probably advertises gold. For gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has ads on his web pages.
Yeah.
Give you an example of some of the things that he says. He said at one point that former President Obama and Hillary Clinton were demons. Literally demons. Demons, okay?
Right.
Not, oh, that guy's a demon. He's like, this person is actually from hell, demon.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. So.
That is profound. He challenged Alec Baldwin to a cage match. He said the Sandy Hook school shooting, which happened in our backyard here in Connecticut, said that this was a government false flag operation, essentially saying it was all a fake.
See, this is where you start you start to get enraged at a person like this.
Not only believed in Pizzagate, you know, the whole like porno thing out of that pizza parlor, you know, high end politicians having sex with kids nonsense. He didn't just believe it, but he talked about it a lot and essentially supported that whole conspiracy theory.
Oh, so, but Jay, to be clear, we don't know if he believed it. He said it.
He said it on his show. Yes.
He promoted it.
Disclaimer here is we don't know what the real Alex Jones actually believes or doesn't believe. We can only comment on his persona that you see on the show. So here's the deal. So the reason why we are bending an eye at this guy, it really isn't because of the stuff that he says, you know, because it really is just lacking any intelligent perspective at all. It's because he's getting divorced, and his divorce actually is very interesting. And the reason why is Jones is currently in a custody battle with his ex-wife, Kelly, over their children, and he wants sole custody of their three children. And she says he's not fit to be a father because, well, you know, look at his show, right? Which, you know, if anyone had seen his show and you think, man, could that guy be a parent with that demeanor? You know, he's temperamental. And she's saying he's temperamental, unstable, he's dangerous. So in response to this, Jones's lawyer, Randall Wilheat, made an amazing comment. He told the state district judge that using his client Alex Jones's on-air InfoWars persona to evaluate Alex Jones as a father would be like judging Jack Nicholson in a custody dispute based on his performance as the Joker in Batman. And then later on, the lawyer continues. He says he's playing a character. He is a performance artist. Now, that makes a very clear line in the sand saying that his on-camera persona is not who the man actually is. And we can only extrapolate from that saying that the beliefs that he shares on his show are probably not his beliefs for who he really is in his right?
Yeah, certainly comes into question, I think.
Then we could start crawling down the rabbit hole now that the stage has been set. So question number one, is Jones putting on this whole persona or is it somewhere in between, you know, some shade of gray between his actual persona on screen and what the lawyer is saying, who he is off screen, you know, is he somewhere in between? And this is where Steve, you know, wants to be careful. And I agree because we don't know what the man actually believes. We can only really comment on his on screen persona. You know, I don't think, though, in my opinion, that he is this hyper rational, calculating, critical thinking person off camera. I just, you know, I have a hard time. I think as a performer, you know, when you think of him as a performer, someone that is putting on a quote unquote show, that over time he's honed his expertise at delivering what his audience wants or what his perception is of what his audience wants. Now, anybody that has an audience as big as Alex Jones, he's aware of his audience because he's gaining a large audience. He's aware of what people want to hear and the types of things that they want to hear talked about, and the way that he's delivering it. So I do think no matter what, I find that to be, you know, true. I think that that's what's actually going on here. But, you know, he could be playing his audience. He really could, and making a great profit off of it. But I again, you know, Steve, and this is just my opinion, I just don't think that off camera he's this calm, rational, even-tempered type of guy. Just doesn't.
But does it have to be that extreme? Can he just not be as crazy?
Sure. There could be any shade of gray in between. I'm just, you know, I am just putting down my two cents on what I think. Or who
you think
he
he's
actually
that crazy?
I mean, I don't think he's as crazy as he is on camera. You know, I've had a lot of experience recording myself with the podcast and, you know, being on camera quite a bit over the last 15 years. And yeah, I mean, when you're on camera, I mean, you do feel like you want the audience to respond. And of course, you know, anybody that is performed in any way knows that there's a pressure that comes with it and you want to deliver whatever it is that you're delivering or expected to deliver. But I absolutely can see how this type of desire could snowball into, you know, creating an on-screen giant persona that, you know, really, really works. So as an example, let's take a look at Terry Jean Bollea, the guy that plays Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan is not who the man really is. And there was this whole, there was a scandal surrounding the Hulk Hogan persona. And, you know, a company went out of business because he sued that company.
Gawker. Yeah.
Gawker. Yeah,
Gawker.
Yeah.
He sued Gawker.
Gawker's and, down.
And he won. And it was a, you know, $100 million lawsuit. It was a huge deal. And we're talking about the man, the actor's personal rights. And, you know, you can't, just because the character that he portrays might be, you know, very sexually oriented or, you know, discussing all these things about what they've done or, you know, who they are as the character. It isn't who the real person is. And when you start attacking the real person because of things that he or she has done while playing a character, I mean, the lines get blurry here, especially with reality TV-based things, you know, things that are, you know, a shade in between the real person and the on-screen persona.
To me, the interesting bit is what this really says about where we are in our society. So I think Alex Jones is like now the perfect representation of our sort of post-truth fake news world.
Media, right? Entertainment,
yeah,
world, right?
So he basically, what his lawyer on his behalf, which is in legally that's the equivalent of him saying it, right? He's signing off on this. He's saying he's a performance artist. Doesn't matter whether, you know, to what extent he believes what he's saying or not. He's saying, so I'm not the person Alex Jones on InfoWars is not a real person who's has like journalistic integrity and responsibility for what he says. It's a character that I'm performing.
Yeah, it's a Stephen Colbert argument.
Yeah, it's a Stephen Colbert. And so,
yeah.
In this case, there, it's like Stephen Colbert, there was always a wink and a nod, right?
Even always. Though it was obvious he was playing
obvious.
A character.
Even though some people missed it, that, you know, you could argue that's like the Onion level where, yeah, come on.
Yeah.
You know, you should know that this is a wink and a nod. But with Alex Jones, he's straight up. I mean, he expects his audience to take his character, his persona, seriously at face value. And so what he's saying essentially is the truth doesn't matter, the reality doesn't matter. This is news as entertainment. I am
right.
Pretending.
Yeah, that's dangerous.
I'm pretending to be giving, you know, this conspiracy, angry, ranting news, playing to the emotions. Some might argue the lowest emotions of my target audience as a persona, but that persona isn't me. And therefore, I'm not really responsible for anything that persona says. So he's giving himself this out. It's all satire.
That's right.
But yet he doesn't kind of give that. Like when you look at Colbert or Jon Stewart, there were times, multiple times, they would talk about, you know, the vast majority of, you know, Americans get their news from The Daily Show. And Jon Stewart would be like, this is not a news show.
Yeah.
Like there was a lot of transparency. Like, this is a comedy show. Like, I feel bad for you if you expect to get your news here because I'm not reporting the news.
Alex doesn't come with a disclaimer.
Disclaimer. Thank you. Yes. He doesn't come with a disclaimer. It's like he's trying to have it both ways. That's really what it is.
Right.
He said on a show after his lawyer's statement, that that's who he really is. His on-camera persona is who he is off-camera, which I found
Well,
I was shocked.
Yeah, a matter of convenience.
I was shocked to hear that.
But then isn't he guilty of perjury?
Probably. I mean, well, I don't know. If he didn't say
it. Well, it depends.
His lawyer said it. I don't know.
Well, yeah, but that's – you. If you're saying something in court, you're filing a document with the court saying this is your position. And the client signs that. That's not the attorney's words.
True.
That's the client who says that, right? You know, when I file my documents on my lawsuit case, I'm signing them from me as if I wrote them.
Yeah, that's true. Know? Can you perjure yourself in, I guess, any court of law?
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
Does he have to – but saying it – but he's not perjuring himself, though, by saying it on air. He can just claim that, again, that's part of his persona. He can just keep going down that rat hole.
Yeah, I don't think he has – as far as his audience is concerned, I don't think he has anything to really lose. I don't think a single one of them is going to turn him off because of this, unfortunately.
That's the other thing, is that because of the nature of his – audience and what he talks about, it's, you know, it's through the looking glass, you know, so everything is topsy-turvy. So he could, you know, anything is a false flag. This whole thing is a false flag. He can get away with anything. There's no reality, right? Which is what's so disturbing about all of this. It's highlighting for me the fact that this is what you get when you have this infotainment where there's no reality.
It's like wrestling compared to sports. You know, wrestling is sports entertainment.
Yeah,
they call
but
it.
it's always
even
understood.
Though they don't say no, this is not real, right?
Yeah, but it's so understood.
But they don't come out and outright say it.
That's true.
Right.
That's true.
And does that turn off any wrestling viewers from watching the show? Not many.
Yeah,
hardly any. And I think the same is true here with Alex.
Yeah, but I wouldn't make a direct comparison between wrestling and Alex Jones, because wrestling is not pretending to be news, you know.
Well,
it's pretending to be sports,
but it isn't really. There is a wink and a nod from wrestling too, you know. But I do agree that blurs the lines a little bit, and there's an analogy there. But it's just, you know, it's wrestling, so who really cares? But this is we're talking about making accusations about the government and about what's
Can't we set precedent?
Yes,
like,
that's
why
right.
don't people sue this guy for libel? Or for slander, and then because if he is a legitimate news outlet and he is actually publishing these things or saying these things, he should be able to be taken to task. And he's not veiling it, and you know, he won't be able to argue comedy or parody. So he's not really covered. Like, there's like legal precedent for this. So
I find it more of an op-ed, an opinion.
Yeah,
rather
that's
than,
true.
He's not a journalist. Mm-hmm. I don't really put him in that classification.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
So last week I played this noisy.
I am perfect. That which is imperfect must be sterilized.
Oh, I love it.
So that just a lot to answer a lot of listeners' questions. That was not Steve.
Yeah.
I can see how they would get confused there, though.
So, all right. So, duh, a lot of people knew this. I did that. You know, I wanted people to have an easy win. Yes, this is obvious to certain people. Let me give a little extra hint before we reveal what it is. Maybe this will help a few stragglers.
I am nomad. I am perfect. That which is imperfect must be sterilized.
You are in error. You did not discover your mistake. You've made two errors. You are flawed and imperfect. And you have not corrected by sterilization. You've made three errors.
Error. Examine.
You are flawed and imperfect.
Okay, so what you're hearing here is...
Oh, my God. Error?
That was Nomad from Star Trek, the original series. So the quick backstory...
Classic.
Look, I'm going to indulge myself, so deal with it. Nomad was created... This was like a thing, say, about the size of...
A water heater.
A water heater, yeah. It was created on Earth in the 21st century. This is all in Star Trek, okay? This isn't real. By a scientist called Jackson Roy Kirk. Nomad's program was to seek out new life and report it back to Earth. So he was damaged in outer space by a meteor, and Nomad drifted until he found Tanru. Pop, Tanru!
Tanru!
This was another alien probe designed to sterilize soil.
Sterilize.
So the two droids, whatever you want to call them, repaired each other, repaired themselves, and they became one droid after the repair was done. This is called Nomad. And now Nomad's programming was so screwed up that joining with Tanru made the two of them now think that they have to destroy anything that is not perfect.
Yeah. All right. This is the future of artificial intelligence, folks, right here. This is a perfect summary.
Yeah. So what happened was Captain Kirk, he managed to convince the probe that it was imperfect because it made a mistake because the probe thought that Captain Kirk was Roy Kirk, who actually created the original probe sent from Earth. So he uses a logic trap to make the at the end you hear Nomad going error. Right. You know, Nomad is all confused, and Captain Kirk used this this ploy in many episodes to mess up many AIs.
Norman,
that's one of his superpowers.
All right, so a lot of people wrote in. I got a lot of fun comments. The winner for last week was Rich Rogalado, and Rich said that's Nomad MK-15C space probe from the original series Star Trek episode The Changeling. So I thought that was I love it when people write back the perfect information. It kind of reminds me of when Bob ends his you know, the superheroes of science, the unknown heroes of science, where you get into that the techno babble at the end. It's real. So I had a couple of notables here. So Todd Dart wrote in, I imagine I am only one of a plethora of Star Trek geeks who recognize this week's Who's That Noisy, but that is the voice of Vic Perrin. So this guy, this actor named Vic Perrin, actually voiced Nomad. I never knew that before. Thank you for that piece of trivia. That was fun. All right, so that was fun. Thank you all for putting up with my, you know, my little slice of geekdom that I had to throw in there that week. I needed it. I needed a boost. Steve got me sick. I completely blame Steve
for the fourth time this episode.
Yes. So I have a new noisy. I hope you enjoy it. So that was a noisy sent in by Marcel Jansessens.
Christensen.
Thank you, Marcel. What the heck is it? If you have any idea what that is, or if you heard something cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Jay, I have an answer to your illness problem.
That which is imperfect must be sterilized.
Anyway, thanks for that, Noisy. That's really a cool one. All right, we have a question from our Facebook page, and the question is this. Hi there. I wanted to verify something, if possible. The article from WebMD states, a varied healthy diet consisting of foods as unprocessed and true to their natural form as possible is as essential to your skin's health as it is to your overall health. But based on the postings of this page, meaning our Facebook page, I was under the impression that this is the appeal to nature fallacy, that there's no chemical difference between natural foods and non-natural. So which is true? I'd really appreciate some help. Thanks. So what do you guys think?
It depends.
So yeah, it depends, meaning that the fact that the food is processed is meaningless.
Yeah, but if it's processed with all sugar, then it's probably not as good for you.
But then what you should say is you should avoid foods that have high amounts of processed sugar or refined sugar. But the key is that it is definitely phrased as an appeal to nature fallacy, right? That you want to eat food that is as true to their natural form as possible. Why? What difference does it make? If you cut up an apple, is it any less of an apple? If you make it into applesauce, you know, is it any less of the same constituents? I mean, how much processing do you have to do before something is not natural?
Well, and also processing foods makes it so that they're shelf stable. It makes it so that you can actually eat them. So for a lot of people, if they don't eat processed food, they can't get food. Like, it's actually quite important to be able to feed people that are not near to the farm.
process
and to fortify.
Yeah, exactly. Processing food might make it better. You might fortify it, make it more digestible, make it more
Absolutely.
Less likely to spoil. You might actually remove some things that are not good for you there. So processing could be neutral; it could make it better, or you could load it up with fat and sugar, and that's not good for you. But yeah. the how natural it is completely irrelevant to how healthful it is. So that you're getting people to focus on the wrong thing. And I do think that that's very right. highly problematic.
Right? It's so common. It's such yeah. a common argument. Like I have friends, I live in Hollywood. Hollywood is full of woo. I literally have friends who have looked in my refrigerator and been like, oh, you have ultra pasteurized milk. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get ultra not infected by it. Like I don't understand why people think it's not good to pasteurize milk.
Because that's not how it came out of the cow.
I know. It's like, no, like, we have avoided so many health crises because of pasteurization. But it's processed, Please. Right? It's ridiculous. Yeah. I don't want to drink. I don't want to drink it with all the like blood and bacteria in it. Thank you.
Right. So, I mean, it's very similar to like the problem with GMOs, like the problems that people have with GMOs, if they're either not true or they're irrelevant to GMOs. They're focusing on the wrong thing. Like if you think, oh, we're taking too simplistic approach to pest management. Okay, then sure, you should promote an integrated pest management, which is perfectly compatible with genetically modified organisms. Yeah. These are two
Or you shouldn't be able to patent
things.
Food. Like a big ag shouldn't patent food. Food should be free. It's like that is a totally different conversation we could be having.
When you read the word natural, think marketing.
Yeah, good call.
Think marketing. That is all.
Exactly.
Not nutrition.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts. Two real and one is fake news. Or one is an alternative news item.
or news-like entertainment.
You have to tell me which one is the fake. Just three regular items this week. You ready?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Item number one, in a new study, researchers find that neurons are able to form a network in the absence of synaptic activity. Item number two, scientists have shown that homing pigeons are able to pass on knowledge to subsequent generations, the first non-primate species to demonstrate this ability. And item number three, scientists find that even starting with a single female cockroach, they are able to reproduce asexually and indefinitely maintain a large population. Jay, go first.
This study saying that neurons are able to form a network in the absence of synaptic activity. All right. Now, I think that there is a tricky little thing in here when Steve's saying there's an absence of synaptic activity. It doesn't mean that the neurons aren't still communicating. In another way. Oh, damn. Okay.
That's actually exactly what it means, that they're not communicating.
All right, so hold on. So, because I know that the brain has a lot of, like, communication is happening on multiple levels and in different ways. But you're saying that, to be specific here, there's no electrical signals going from one neuron to the next. But they're
That's
still
correct.
Able to form a network. How would they do that? Are they communicating through the blood? I don't know. All right, I got to put that one on hold. Let's go on to the next one. Scientists have shown that homing pigeons, they can pass on knowledge to their kids and other friends and neighbors. I think this one is science because I own a bird and I know how intelligent birds are, and this doesn't surprise me at all. So I will say that one is science. And this last one, I hope that I know what this is because I don't know enough about the first one. So this one is that scientists, they're even starting with a single female cockroach, they're able to reproduce asexually and indefinitely maintain a large population. Well, that does kind of make sense with how I perceive these filthy cockroaches. They can take one female and just keep making more cockroaches, huh? Yeah, I think that I will not say that insects can't do weird stuff like that. So I'm going to say that the first one, the one about neurons, is definitely the fiction.
Okay, Evan?
I'll take them in reverse order. Scientists find that even starting with a single female cockroach, wasn't that a movie? Oh, that was single white female, able to reproduce asexually. Well, I could have sworn, I read a long time ago, that there was a myth about cockroaches being able to reproduce asexually, but that was a long time ago. I hadn't really thought about it or read much about it since, so I'm thinking maybe 15 years ago. But certainly scientists have learned a lot in 15 years, and perhaps this is one of the things that they have discovered, that yes, there is asexual reproduction occurring within the female cockroach. So I have a feeling that one's going to be science. The next one, about homing pigeons passing on knowledge to subsequent generations. And the first non-primate species to demonstrate it. Very interesting. Homing pigeons specifically, huh? Yeah, I have a feeling also that this one is going to be science. Well, that leaves the one about neurons forming a network in the absence of synaptic activity. The one I know the least about, I suppose, of the three items. So I'm going to have to go with Jay. I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
The synapses, I could kind of see that some networks could potentially form because, just like these gross networks that are most likely going to be formed, and then maybe all the fine tuning can be, that requires synaptic activity. I could imagine that could possibly work. I don't know enough about it to say clearly this can't happen because of blah, blah, blah. The bird one. Yeah. I'm totally buying that. Birds are awesome. So that one's, I say that's science. The last one here, the cockroach, man, I'm having trouble with that too. Cockroaches reproducing asexually. That just, granted, I don't know much about cockroach sexuality, but that just doesn't seem right. Screw it. I'm going to go with cockroach fiction.
Okay, Kara?
Okay, I'm going to start in the middle. Homing pigeons are able to pass on knowledge to subsequent generations, the first non-primate species to demonstrate this ability. This one seems like it could be science, but maybe it's not the first non-primate species. That's a real kicker right there. But I'm going to go with the group and say that one is science. What I'm struggling with in the neuron one is the clarification that you gave to Jay. In a new study, researchers find that neurons are able to form a network in the absence of synaptic activity. Well, they definitely have to communicate in order to organize. That said, you're not defining synaptic activity. Like, you're not defining it as requiring neurotransmitter. I bet you could cheat if you jolted the presynaptic and postsynaptic cells into thinking that they were communicating, even though there was no neurotransmitter release, so that it was purely electric and not electrochemical. But since it doesn't qualify that, It's just so top line. Like, this one's really vague, so it's bothering me. Scientists find that even starting with a single female cockroach, they're able to reproduce asexually and indefinitely maintain a large population. How could they ever know that? How could they ever know it was indefinite? That bugs me.
I do think.
Yeah. Hi-yo. I do think I know that cockroaches can do parthenogenesis like sharks can. I think I've read that, but I don't know. This has so many details. A single female cockroach. Maybe you need more than one. Reproduce asexually. Okay, that part I get. And indefinitely maintain a large population. Maybe they can only make a small population, or maybe it dies out after, two goes. Or maybe their offspring can't reproduce. I don't know if I go with the group or if I go with Bob. I don't know how they could make a network without any functional neurons, but maybe I'm oversimplifying it. Maybe the neurons are functional. They're just cheating somehow and skipping what I think of as classical synapse. But I'm still going to go with the guys and say the neuron one's fiction.
Okay. All right, Bob, you're out on your own there.
But you all
agree on the second one, so we'll start there. Scientists have shown that homing pigeons are able to pass on knowledge to subsequent generations, the first non-primate species to demonstrate this ability. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yes.
Yay.
Yes, birds is smart. So the way they looked at the efficiency with which homing pigeons homed, did their thing, and that they found that they were gradually able to improve their flight paths over time, and that this improvement was passed down to subsequent generations, so that the learning was passed on to younger pigeons. So
passed on genetically or passed on through teaching?
It must have been culturally. Yeah, culturally.
Gotcha. Okay.
Cultural.
Yeah.
Through teaching. That knowledge you know, so essentially there was cumulative knowledge across generations, that each generation wasn't starting from scratch. So that's very interesting. And again, that's
super cool.
Obviously humans do that. We have cultural generational knowledge. There have been monkeys that teach each other how to do things, like, you know, fish potatoes out of sand or whatever, or, you know, wash the fruit.
Why are there potatoes in sand?
They wash them off, you know, in the water. Oh.
It's like an arbitrary life skill there.
Yeah. You know, like those, what are they called?
Sand potatoes.
The sand potatoes.
It's coarse. It gets everywhere.
The worst. I do get that one.
Yeah, but this is the first time in a non-primate species they have shown this.
Very cool.
Yeah. Very cool. I bet you, though, that they'll find it, like the dolphins do similar things.
Probably. I bet you octopuses do too.
Somebody email us. But you know, the scientific report that I'm reading said, this is an Oxford University, so they're saying this is the first time in non-primates. So yeah. I'm just quoting them.
So we just need to go demonstrate it in other species now.
Yeah, could be. All right, let's go back to number one.
A
new study, researchers find that neurons are able to form a network in the absence of synaptic activity. Evan, Jay, and Kara think this one is the fiction. Mm-hmm. Bob thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah.
Wow.
Good job, right. Bob. Solo win for Bob. Yeah, this one's interesting. This one.
So how'd they do it?
Yeah.
How'd they do it?
Come on.
Was I close? Was my guess anywhere near
wireless? What are we talking here?
So it wasn't just they genetically engineered a strain of mice that cannot produce glutamate in the hippocampus. So they essentially can't secrete the neurotransmitter that is responsible for forming networks. And to see if those mice would still have any behavior that requires networks. And they did. So the idea here is, we know that neurons that fire together wire together, right? That's the mantra
in
neurology. Yeah. So that when neurons communicate through neurotransmitters, that causes them to network together. They make connections between each other. However, it does seem that animals and even people are born with some behaviors already cooked in. And the question was, well, are these networks able to form purely genetically without any neuronal activity? And so that's been studied for a while. There actually was a previous study where they looked at mice that were altered so that their neurons didn't function at all. But though they died very quickly, so unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
So the advance here was, but although it did seem that they did have some, you know, working networks in among their neurons, but they just didn't really develop very much because they just died so quickly. So here they had more limited, you know, deficits in these mice. They weren't able to make certain neurotransmitters for certain networks, but their neurons weren't totally gimped. So they still were able to function long enough for them to, although they were impaired, they were able to, you know, develop into adults. And what they found was that even the neurons that were unable to communicate electrochemically still were engaging in networks, and that they were probably genetically determined. So that neurons will form a network, at least some basic networks that are entirely based on genetic information and not on neuronal activity, not on, you know, a firing connection among the neurons.
But you said they only knocked out glutamate.
Well, that's what they said.
So couldn't they have been using a different excitatory neurotransmitter?
But these were glutamate neurons. You know, there's like some neurons only use one neurotransmitter.
I feel like maybe we need to know what's going on in a glutamate neuron that can't synthesize glutamate, because maybe they have a secondary way to use a different neurotransmitter.
It's one study. So yes, you have to ask about what else might be going on, but that was their hypothesis. That's what they showed. And it does make sense in that, you know, they say that animals are born with networks even before they really had a chance to do anything. Right? Like, you know, horses can run like minutes after being born or something, right? I mean,
They had still like so like yeah. But would you call it a network if they're not synaptically connected? Like
yeah, that's the thing. They are connected. That's the whole point. Okay. They are connected.
The synapse is there. It's just totally dysfunctional, or I should say non-functional. It's completely quiet, yeah. And they're sure.
Yeah, it formed a network. I didn't say the networks themselves were functioning because they're not. They're not producing glutamate, but they were formed. Yeah. So that's the interesting bit, is that the networks can form from some other, there's something else forming those networks. That's the follow-up studies they need to do then. How are these networks forming if they're not just responding to neurotransmitters, which is the usual thing that we know about?
Yeah,
right?
Like the neurites grow because they want to find those trophic factors, and they hang out in the right place.
Yeah.
Because I guess there are trophic factors that are neurotransmitter.
Exactly.
Yeah, it could just be proteins that are doing it, and that would all be encoded in the DNA. That's
exactly
true.
That's what they think. That's exactly what they think. So obviously, we need to do a lot of follow up study, but this is cool. It's a new wrinkle, you know, and it kind of makes sense. Again, the reason why they thought about this was because of the idea that there are some networks which are genetically determined that are not based on use or function. They're just there because of the genes. So this supports that. Interesting. Okay, let's go to number three. Scientists find that even starting with a single female cockroach, they are able to reproduce asexually and indefinitely maintain a large population. So that one is the fiction, but Kara is right. Cockroaches are able to asexually reproduce, parthenogenesis. A lot of species can, a lot of insects as well as some amphibians, reptiles, etc. can do
that.
Work?
It's a X to X. That's why only females can do it.
Yeah,
men couldn't do it, because if you had two Ys, it would abort.
Yeah, right. So usually this strategy is a way of sort of temporarily maintaining your population numbers in the absence of available males, right? So, but what the study and previous studies, this is a follow-up to previous studies, and together what they show is that while cockroaches can do this, if a single female cockroach will do it very little, and the population will die out very quickly. When you have multiple females together, they are able to produce asexually much more quickly and maintain a larger population. But even then, it's only temporary. So like about 3 years, which is still a long time, but not indefinitely.
Yeah. That
was definitely the thing that you were correct. So asexual reproduction is a stopgap measure, right? It's just something you do just so that you can maintain your population. So I guess in some populations, like numbers matter, like just for the survival, you need to have numbers. And then if you're going through a dip in the population, this is a little hedge against that. So the females could just produce asexually. You sacrifice your genetic diversity because you don't really have a lot of genetic diversity when you do that, but you could at least maintain your numbers for mutual defense or whatever it is that you need your numbers for until you can have there are enough males available to revert back to sexual reproduction. But these are always temporary stopgap measures, and that's what this showed as well. The new bit here was that, like, if you have five or six female cockroaches together, they do it much quickly and much more efficiently than a single female cockroach can't really do it very well.
And why is that? Is it because they help take care of the young, or is it some sort of hormone situation that's happening?
That's a good question. What they found was that it is some kind of hormone the females are secreting to each other, because if you get rid of their hormone sensing antenna, the effect goes away. But it's not the sex pheromones. It's some non-pheromone hormonal signal that the females are exchanging that are triggering the parthenogenesis. Yeah.
It's going to be oxytocin, isn't it?
Who knows?
I don't know if cockroaches have oxytocin.
I don't know either.
It sounds like a complex molecule for them, but who knows?
Right. So this is pretty much in line with what we know about parthenogenesis. If indefinitely maintaining a large population would definitely be new. And that it did not show that.
And it would be genetically inferior, right? It would not be advantageous for a species to be able to do that. But since they did this like in a lab, it seems like you can push past kind of some of those evolutionary limits in a lab. But I guess in this case, you can't.
All right. Well, good job, Bob. Good solo win this week.
Yeah. Nice job.
Bob.
Yeah, Bob. Well done.
All right. Evan, give us a quote this week.
All right. Well, the quote this week was suggested by listener Joel Glenister. Thank you, Joel, for suggesting this, because I really do like it. The world we live in is beautiful to look at, but it's even more beautiful to understand. Quote comes from Professor Brian Cox. We do love Brian Cox, English physicist, professor of particle physics, the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Manchester. Perhaps you've seen him on any number of science shows that you've enjoyed from BBC or other channels, in which he breaks down very complex subjects most eloquently, most beautifully, and presents them to people, much in the same way Carl Sagan used to do, I find. I think he has a lot of those same exact talents. So Brian Cox.
Yeah, he's a great science communicator. Absolutely.
Fantastic.
He is. He's very talented.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And very likable. Just a likable guy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Always always smiling, always pleasant, that nice voice. He's got it all.
Which you got to be, yeah. Definitely. He's not an asshole like we are.
No, we're elitist, Steve.
Yeah, we're elitist
That's
assholes.
Right.
Yeah. This is like the unweaving the rainbow thing, which I totally agree with. You know, even when I was very young, I rejected this argument that, oh, if you try to understand reductionist scientifically how things work, then they lose their beauty and mystery and bullshit.
Oh, my God.
No way.
Yeah, that's layers to the beauty.
I know.
Come
you
on.
Appreciate things so much more. I mean, you know, you appreciate the beauty in a spiral galaxy when you know a little bit something about scale and how galaxies work and how complicated
and
they are.
Dark
and all that
matter.
Stuff. Yeah, I mean, there is absolutely beauty in understanding the natural world.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the flat Earth is gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's only mostly flat. Right.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.